perspective. So the title I gave this is, Are Their Fates Worse Than Death? Which is a title that I guess is inspired actually by the talk by Goldberg was asking, you know, are there, well, he was stating, there are things that are worse than death. And we're discussing end of life in halakha. And the way that I want to do this is tonight, I don't know how much we're going to get to do tonight because I don't want to go too late into the night. Rahmanas and everybody here, including myself and my wife. But I do want to at least get to the first section. And in the first section, we're going to be looking at just the primary sources, some raw data. Basically, Gemara after Gemara after Gemara. And I think they're probably slanted in one way, but you can make the judgment by yourself. And we're really concentrating only on one aspect of end of life, which is probably the most important aspect, which is there ever a time when you basically, as the patient or as the person caring for the patient, say, okay, enough is enough. It's not appropriate, or it's not compassionate to continue, or no, or is it always right to continue? So we're going to look at a few Gemaras. The most famous, by far, the primary source for many of the poskim is the first one we're going to see, because we have to make sure that we get that one in the bag. Okay, so this is a Gemara in Ketubot. Let me make it a little bit bigger so that my father can read it. Okay, here we go. Let me move this to the top, and there we go. Okay, so this is a Gemara in Ketubot. Kuf Dalet Amud Aleph, all the way at the end. It says as follows. It's related that on the day that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi died, this is when Rebbe died, the sages decreed a fast and begged for divine mercy so that he would not die. Okay, so you know, all the students, these rabbis getting together to pray that nothing would happen to him, even though they knew he was sick. And they said so far that anyone who says that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi has died will be stabbed with a sword. In other words, they made a threat. Nobody should even say the words. The maidservant, the Amma of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who is actually quite famous. There are a lot of statements in the Gemara about the maidservant of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. She was a Tamidah Chachama. She wasn't Jewish, but she was a Tamidah Chachama. I say she wasn't Jewish. I don't know whether she was Jewish. She was so learned that people used to go to her to actually learn the meaning of words because she was privy to a lot of the knowledge of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So she ascended to the roof and said, the upper realms are requesting the presence of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Shamayim wants him, and the lower realms are requesting the presence of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. May it be the will of God that the lower world should impose their will upon the upper world. So she was at first on the side of the rabbis, the students of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who were praying to keep him down here. However, when she saw how many times he would enter the bathroom and remove his tefillin and then exit and put them back on, and how he was suffering with his intestinal disease, some of this is added. This is not the Sansino. This is Faria's version of the Gemara. So it's I think it's the English version of the Steinsaltz. It's the Davidson version. So it makes it a little bit easier to read. And so she would see how much pain he was going through, how much of a tircha it was that he would have to keep, you know, putting his tefillin back on and taking them off to go to the bathroom, and it was painful. She said, she switched. So she shifted sides. May it be the will of God that the upper worlds should impose their will upon the lower worlds. And the sages, meanwhile, would not be silent. They didn't stop. They wouldn't refrain from begging for mercy that he wouldn't die. So what did she do? She took a jug and she threw it from the roof to the ground, making a loud noise. And the sages stopped for just a moment. It's reminiscent, actually, of the Gemara about David HaMelech at the end of his life, that he was distracted by the Malach HaMavet making a loud noise so that he would look up from his learning. And the sages stopped davening, and that immediately caused Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi to die. The sages said to Bar Kapara, go and ascertain the condition of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. They sent Bar Kapara, poor Bar Kapara. He went and found that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi had died. So he tore his clothing and reversed them so that the tear would be behind him and not be noticed. So he tore his clothing as per halacha, but he didn't want anybody to see it because he didn't want to get in trouble, right? He'd be announcing to everybody that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi had died, and they just threatened that anybody who does that is going to be killed. So he tried to make sure that nobody noticed it. And we returned to the sages. He opened his remarks and said, the angels and righteous mortals both clutched the sacred ark. The angels triumphed over the righteous and the sacred ark was captured. So he kind of made a remiss. He made a riddle out of it. They said to him as he died, he said to them, you said it. I didn't say it. I wasn't the one who said it, so you can't blame me. As it has been decided that no one should say that he died. It is further related. Okay. Yeah. Basically, this is the story that interests us. So what happened over here? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was I don't know if he was a goseis, but he wasn't a goseis. He was able to put on his tefillin, take off his tefillin. He was in pain. He was suffering. But he wasn't yet at death's door, it doesn't seem, because he was still able to go to the bathroom by himself, it seems, take on, put on, unless maybe somebody was doing it for him, I don't know. But he was definitely in pain. And all of a sudden, the Amma, his maidservant, decided that that's it. We're going to get the rabbis to stop praying. Now, there's a few things we learned from this. Number one, according to the Gemara, it's the prayers that kept him alive, and, which is, you know, astonishing because, you know, that means that they're praying, even though if in the... Okay, so how do we understand the conclusion of this Gemara? One of you, what's the conclusion of the Gemara? What did we learn? What are the values that we get from this? Is it clear?
That prayer helps. The prayer is the solution.
That as long as you pray for somebody, they can't die.
In certain cases, in certain people, with certain rebellion.
Okay. Fine. And should this prayer always be employed?
That's the issue.
So it's kind of funny if you think about it. Meaning, I would have said, I mean, I think intuitively, we're all on the side of the maidservant, right? It seems like we're supposed to be on the side of the maidservant at the end of the Gemara. I mean, she succeeded, she prevailed, and the Gemara tells the story from her perspective, at least for part of the time. But on the other hand, how are we to understand the fact that these rabbis are all praying and God is listening to their prayers? I mean, isn't the Amma on the side of God's will? Is it, if it's God's will that Rebbe should die, so then why is he listening to their prayers? Is it some kind of magic incantation in their prayers that it's going against God's will? There's like an internal contradiction over here, a philosophical internal contradiction, at least that I see. Unless you say, no, the Amma was wrong, totally wrong, and she ruined it. And she killed Rebbe. Does anyone want to read the Gemara that way? That she's completely wrong and she shouldn't have done that. But at least if you read it that way, the Gemara itself is consistent, right? Because the rabbis are praying for him. When they stopped praying, he died. If they had continued to pray, he wouldn't have died. Okay, well, I think there is a little bit, at least a little bit of ambiguity in the Gemara because it doesn't really come to a clear conclusion. It doesn't say, and the Amma was right.
Which the Gemara has nothing, the Gemara doesn't have anything negative to say about the Amma, doesn't have any punishment to mete out to her. It's just, happened.
No, it doesn't have anything negative to say about the Amma, and I guess it could have. The Gemara sometimes has very bad things to say about people like that, if it was the wrong decision. But it also doesn't laud her, and it doesn't criticize the rabbis.
And it doesn't even mention whether the rabbis themselves criticized her for her action.
It doesn't sound like, right, no, it doesn't. It doesn't. Okay.
I think that if you take this as not only a factual story, but as a parable to other stories, you could say there are two sides. There's the religious side that says, I want this person to stay around because he's my Rebbe, because I need to learn from him, because he still has things to say. And the human side, a person who sees the internal suffering of this person and says, it's enough already.
Right.
Time to go.
Right. There's the people who need the patient, and then there's the patient and their needs. Okay. Here's another Gemara in Sota. So the Gemara in Sota has a bunch of statements about Sancheriv and Nebuchadnezzar, and it talks about the city Luz. And Luz was a city that Sancheriv came, and he exiled many nations from place to place, but he did not disarrange and exile its inhabitants. In other words, Luz stayed as it was. Nebuchadnezzar also came, conquered many lands. He didn't destroy Luz. And even the angel of death has no permission to pass through it. Meaning, Luz is a place nobody can mess with it. The people in Luz are so righteous that they couldn't be conquered, they couldn't be exiled, and even the Malach HaMavet has no control over them. Okay, so what does that mean? Does that mean that everybody in Luz lives forever? Rather, no, it says it's elders when they decide that they have reached the end of life, they go outside the city wall and they die. Nobody dies in Luz, not a natural death, not an unnatural death. People in Luz, when they reach the end of their life, whatever that means, they go outside the city wall and they die. Now what does that mean? What do you make of this? Leave aside the physics of it and the medicine of it. What is the Gemara trying to say? Certainly,
man has a choice when he dies.
Exactly. It sounds like they're making a choice. Now, what is the choice based on? Especially if they know that if they stay in the city, they'll never die, right? That's what it sounds like. So one way to say it is, you know, most likely is that they're in pain, they're suffering. Even though they're never going to die, they have old age and with all the ailments that come with it. And so that's why they decide, okay, I've had enough. Alternatively, nothing like that happens. They just get bored, right? They say, okay, I've had enough of this life. I think I'm ready to move on to the next section. That could be.
There's a third choice. The first choice is, in this city, people make the decision. It is left to them, and they are expected to make the right choice, whatever that is for themselves.
But so how do you read this? Is it would they die in the city if they stayed in the city or not? It sounds, on the face of it, according to the Gemara, they would not die. They would just go on living forever, I guess. Or, you know, maybe it's a question of causality. Maybe just the point is that the people in the city have the good sense that when they realize that their time is up, they go outside the city so that they don't want to bring death into the city. That could be. But it's just another interesting source over here that questions whether or not it's worth it always to continue, or whether there's a time when time is up. So Gemara Avodah Zarah, another Gemara over here. This is another famous, famous Gemara. This is the one that we talk about on Tisha B'Av. So it's telling the story of the Asar HaRogei Malchut. It says that a few days after Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma died of his illness and all the Roman notables went to bury him, they eulogized him with a great eulogy. And when they came back, they found Rabbi Chanina ben Tradio, the famous Rabbi Chanina ben Tradio, was sitting and engaging in Torah study. And he was teaching in public, and he had a Torah scroll in his lap. And the Romans, who had decreed against public Torah study, they brought him to be sentenced, and they wrapped him in the Torah scroll. They covered him in bundles of branches, and they set fire to him. Right, so he is up in a conflagration. But to make it even worse, they brought tufts of wool soaked in water, and they placed that on his body, on his heart, so that he wouldn't die so quickly. But he would die more painfully. His daughter said to him, "Father, do I have to see you like this?" And Rabbi Chanina ben Tradio said, "You know, it's not just me that's burning; it's the Torah's burning. Right? This is where the letters are flying up to heaven." But what interests us over here is when the student said to him, "You too should open your mouth, and the fire will enter you, and you'll die quickly." Okay, so they want him to make his end come more quickly and end his suffering. He's burning. Rabbi Chanina ben Tradio said to them, "It is preferable that he who gave me my soul should take it away, and one should not harm oneself to speed his death." So I'm not allowed, basically. He says, I can't open up my mouth and let the fire go in, because then I would be killing myself. I have to just wait. The executioner said to him, "My teacher, if I increase the flame and take off the tusks of wool from your heart so that you will die sooner and suffer less, will you bring me to life in the world to come?" And he says, "Yes." The executioner says, "Swear it to me." Rabbi Chanina swears. The executioner increased the flame, took off the wool, and then he himself jumped in, and they both died. And a divine voice, a bat call, comes out and says, "Rabbi Chanina ben Tradio and the executioner get to go to the world to come, get to go to Olam Haba." This is one of the places where Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says, he cries out and he says, "Yesh kona olam habashah achas." There are those that acquire the world to come in one moment. That's the execution over here. What do we make of this one? What's going on over here? Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradio said, "I can't open my mouth." Why can't he open up his mouth?
He wasn't ready to hasten his own death, but he did allow someone else to do it for him.
Yeah, that's striking, isn't it? I mean, what are we to make of this? Is he not worried that the executioner is hastening his death, that he's becoming a murderer, so to speak?
No, I would say that would show you that, yes, someone else can do it. If one sees someone else is suffering and can ease it, can do it. One cannot do that for themselves.
So it's okay for somebody else to do it, but it's not okay for me to do it for myself.
But the executioner. The executioner still went to Olam Haba, even though he killed himself.
The executioner killed himself.
Yeah, so clearly,
yeah, that's true. That's true. There's a lot of quirks over here. It's also hard to believe that really this is the one thing that he did in his whole life, right?
I mean, he was an executioner for the Romans. One must imagine that he wasn't necessarily the best of fellows.
Yeah, it's quite amazing that there's one deed that he did, and that should really atone for everything. It's hard to imagine. That requires a drasha in and of itself. It needs investigation. But what's interesting to me over here is a couple of elements. Number one, he is completely unwilling, Rabbi Chanan ben Tzaddik, completely unwilling to open his mouth and hasten his death as he's burning. He's burning to death. How much longer is he going to survive anyways, right? There is no hope. There's no cure here. Nobody's saying Refuah Shleimah to Rabbi Chanan ben Tzaddik. He's burning to death. All they're saying is end it a little bit earlier by opening your mouth, and he's unwilling to do it. But then on the other hand, he's willing to let the executioner do it. Very interesting. Another Gemara, Bava Kama.
Can I intervene? The executioner's purpose there was to not only to hasten his death, but to relieve his suffering. That might have something, might be something important to the event there. He didn't just say, I'm going to open your mouth so you die faster. Well, I'm going to remove the wet cotton from around your heart.
Killed him faster.
All right, but it relieved the suffering. That was the point of the executioner's activity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's a Gemara, which is an interesting contrast to the Gemara of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi in terms of the ending. So you know, everybody knows the story of Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan. Rish Lakish was a bandit. He was off the Derech Jew, presumably, who was stealing from people, and then he stole from the wrong guy. He stole from Rabbi Yochanan, tried to steal from Rabbi Yochanan, ended up marrying Rabbi Yochanan's sister, becoming a big Talmid Chacham, his Chavrusa. Unfortunately, the end of that story is very tragic. They get into some kind of argument, and Reish Lakish basically dies because of the Agmat Nefesh caused by this argument. Won't get into the details with Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was sorely pained over losing him, over losing Reish Lakish, his Chavrusa. So the rabbi said, who's going to calm Rabbi Yochanan's mind? So they assigned a new Chavrusa, Elazar ben Pedat, because he was the best student. So he used to learn with Rabbi Yochanan, and famously, Rabbi Yochanan got very angry with Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat. Why? Because every time Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat would respond to Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan would say something, and Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat would bring, 24 proofs in favor of Rabbi Yochanan's argument, which is something that should have made him very happy, but it didn't. Because Rabbi Yochanan said, what do I need you to bring me proofs? When I used to learn with Reish Lakish, he would ask me 24 questions. And then by answering up his questions, the halacha would be sharpened. And you're a yes man. You give me 24 reasons and supports. I already know what I'm saying is right. I don't need your support. You're not making me any smarter. The end of the Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan went around rending his clothing, weeping and saying, where are you, son of Lakish? Where are you, son of Lakish? Yochanan screamed until his mind was taken from him and he went insane. That's the commentary over here. The rabbis prayed and requested for God to have mercy on him and take his soul, and Rabbi Yochanan died. So this is an interesting contrast with Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the Talmidim were begging Hashem not to take him. Rabbi Yochanan, they actually pray that Hashem should take him. How do we understand the contradiction, but definitely a contrast between those two stories?
No, because the first one, you have the, he's going to die immediately. He's going to die within 5 minutes anyway. And so the death will happen quickly. Whereas with this Rav Yochanan, the story, he could carry on living for an amount of time and deteriorate, and nobody wanted to see that deterioration. Uh-huh. Think of somebody with Alzheimer's or something like that. It just deteriorates slowly.
I see.
But okay. According to this Gemara, they're not talking about any physical or health ailments.
Doesn't seem like it.
Of Rabbi Yochanan. They're talking about he went insane.
Yeah.
He could have lived for years and years with it.
Yeah. That just proves it. That just backs up. If he has Alzheimer's, the Gemara. It's a mind thing. It's not a physical thing.
Well,
and it's not only a matter of time. And I think unfortunately, there's a different approach to mental illness and what it means in a Judaism than a physical illness. And I think that it is more severe, or let's say more critical, or the attitude to mental illness is like something much more dramatic than.
So that's interesting, Ravid. You seem to be saying, and I mean, maybe this bears this out, is that there's more suffering with mental illness than there is with physical. In other words, when the rabbis looked at Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, They said, all right, so you have trouble. You know, it's hard for you to get up in the morning. Yeah. And you have to go to the bathroom all the time. And it's painful. Yeah. But we need you. And you still have a clear mind. And we can use you. And you serve, you know, you serve a very, very important purpose. And you're a Rebbe. And we love you. And we need you to teach us. Rav Yochanan, once his, you know, I mean, there could be two ways to go with this. One is that they say, well, Rav Yochanan is now, I don't want to be crude, but he's useless to us now.
Yeah, no good.
But maybe it's more than that, like what you're saying, Ravid, which is that they felt even worse for Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan, he would not want to continue like this because, you know, he has no quality of life. He's gone insane. He's despondent. And perhaps it was because of that. Mm-hmm. That's possible.
I don't know that the rabbis would have had the same reaction if some Chaim Yankel in the street was going insane. The fact that it was Rabbi Yochanan obviously made a difference.
Maybe.
I had a friend once whose mother unfortunately had Alzheimer's, and she said, the phrase she uses, it's like the body was there, but the person was gone.
Well, there are stages, right?
Yeah.
There are stages.
Yeah. But I mean, but you know, mental illness is very different from physical because, you know, I don't know what Judaism, how Judaism looks at the what's happened to the neshama of someone who's not functioning in any kind of rational human way anymore, you know?
Right. Okay, so I want to look at one last Gemara and then a comment by the Ran, very important comment by the Ran. So the Gemara Nedarim says as follows, Rav Chelbo fell ill and there was no one who came to visit him. Rav Kahana said to the sages, didn't the incident involving one of the students of Rabbi Kiva who became sick transpire in that manner? Didn't we have the same thing? One of Rabbi Kiva's students became sick. And what happened? In that case, the sages did not go to visit him, right? The same as Rav Chelbo. And Rabbi Kiva went in to visit him. And then he instructed his students to come and care for him. And what happened? They swept and they sprinkled water on the dirt floor before the sick student. They just took care of the house and everything. And he recovered, the student. The student said to Rabbi Kiva, my teacher, you saved me, you revived me. From that moment, Rabbi Kiva went out and taught with regard to anyone who does not visit the ill, it is as though he is spilling blood. You don't visit an ill person, it's like you're killing them. As it could be that the sick person has no one to care for him, and if there are no visitors, no one will know his situation, and therefore no one will come to his aid. This is actually the basis of the Gemara, the Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch. He says the main thing when a person does Bikur Cholim is to go and to see the person and to pray for them. That's a little bit of what we're gonna see in the Hemshech Lemar. Let me actually keep reading. When Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael to Babylonia, he said, anyone who visits the ill causes that he will live. Anyone who does not visit the ill causes that he will die. Bikur Cholim can be life or death. The Gemara asks, how? In what way are his actions the cause of that result? How am I saving somebody by visiting them? If we say that anyone who visits the ill pleads for mercy from God that he will live, and anyone who does not visit the ill pleads for mercy that he will die, does it enter your mind that he would pray that the sick person will die? What are you saying? You're saying that anybody who goes to visit a sick person, they pray that the person should live, and therefore the person lives. But anyone who doesn't, they're praying that the person should die? What? They're just not. They're not praying anything. Rather, no. Anyone who does not visit the ill does not plead for mercy for him, neither that he will live nor that he will die. And that's bad enough. Since he might have saved the person with first prayers had he visited, his failure to visit is tantamount to causing his death. In other words, the Gemara assumed at first that, okay, if you don't visit, then it means that you're praying for them not to live, praying for them to die. The Gemara says, no, we don't say that. We're just saying that if you don't visit, then you don't pray at all. And if you don't pray at all, then you're basically responsible. This is what I was talking about. He said, the Rama says the main reason for a person to visit Bikur Cholim is to see the state of that person and then to pray for them. That's why there are actually some interesting halachot about visiting a person. You're not supposed to visit too early in the morning or too late at night. Too early in the morning, the person has too much strength. They look fine. You don't get the impression that they need your prayer at all. Too late at night, they look terrible. They look like they're too far gone and they're not going to survive at all. So you have to find the sweet spot. You visit in the middle of the day. Obviously, this is all, you know, it depends. Every single situation is different. The point is that you should try to visit a person when you think that they're in a state of where they need your prayer, but they're not too far gone. That's the most effective.
It sounds a little bit like you might have an extended analogy here. If not visiting a person And not praying for him means it's tantamount to causing his death because you haven't done anything that you could have done. You might say that not providing a person with the medical care that he could have been entitled to, you may be responsible for his death by not causing him or getting him that medical care that he needed.
Yeah, and it goes even beyond medical care. As the Rama also comments, it says the other reason you do Birkei Cholim is to do things for the sick person and not even just medical care. Look at this Gemara. The Gemara talks about Rabbi Akiva's students coming in, sprinkling water on the dirt floor. That means nothing to us. We don't have dirt floors. But the idea was that they cleaned up for him. They swept. They took care of the house so that the person felt like, okay, you know, they're treating me with dignity. There's a house to return to if I get better. People are caring for me. They care about me. That's beyond medical care, standard medical care even. And that's also part of Bikur Cholim. That I think we intuitively know, that that's the point of Bikur Cholim, is to show the person that you care. It's the end of the Gemara that talks about praying for the person. That's the Chiddush that the Rama mentions. Now, the Ran over here, this is the Ran in the Darim. Anytime you quote a Ran, it's almost always a Ran in the Darim, because there's no Rashi in the Darim. That's the deal. So the Ran takes the place of Rashi, but he overdoes it. He writes too much. But everything he writes is gold. Everything he writes is important. So what he says over here is actually a callback to the Gemara in Ksuvos, the first Gemara that we quoted. It's a critically important Ran. I'm not exactly sure how well it fits into the words of the Gemara, his comment, but the fact that he said it is important enough. He says, this is on the words in the Gemara, Ein mevakesh al avrachamim lo sheyichya v'lo sheyamut. A person who doesn't show up, he doesn't pray not for death and not for life. He says, Nira be'einai dehachi ka'amar. Says, it seems to me like this is what it's saying. Pa'amim, by the way, this is what Rabbi Nieta was quoting before, if you were at the thing, but she didn't even go far enough. She just said that that you might pray for other things, that you know you don't have to pray for the person to live, you can pray for other things. But she didn't go far enough. This is what the Ran actually says. Pa'amim shetzarich levakesh rachamim al chole sheyamut. Sometimes it's necessary to pray for the person to actually die when a person is suffering greatly. And he can't live. And the Gemara quotes the Gemara in Ketubot. This is how you know that the Ran did know how to read the Gemara in Ketubot. He was sure about it. When the maidservant saw how much pain he was in, how much suffering he was going through with the tefillin in the bathroom, so she prayed that heaven should win and take Rebbe. It's praying that he should die. A person who doesn't visit, he can't even pray that the person should die because you don't know the state of that person. Only if you visit can you know what the person needs. And then, if the situation calls for it, even pray that that person should die. I can't read this Gemara and read the Ran without mentioning something that my wife told me a long time ago when she went to visit her grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, was a rabbi in Detroit for many, many years. She was actually there when he passed. And she remembers being in the hospice room with him on the night, I think it was the night before, it was the week of. He was totally out of it. He was unconscious for a long time, actually. And he was on hospice. And she remembers being in the room praying, saying Tehillim. And then she was davening, proper Shemona Esrei, and she was reading from the Siddur. And the Siddur, in the second paragraph of the Amidah, right? What does it say? Mechalkel chayim b'chesed, mechayim mitim b'rachamim rabim, somech noflim v'rofei cholim, u'matira asurim, u'mekayim u'manato l'shnei afar, right? And she just stopped, and she realized what the import of the words were. What does Matira Surim mean? What does it mean when we wake up in the morning? It means that he lets us move, right? Or it means, Matira Surim means to be taken out of jail. That's what it means, to release the bound, right? But read it in the Shemona Esrei, and you get a very different impression. Mechalkel chayim bechesed. Okay, Hashem treats us when we're alive, He treats us with chesed. Mechalkel chayim bechesed. Mechayim etim berachamim rabim. Then what happens? Someich nuflim, those who are falling, He holds them up. Verofei cholim, those who have already fallen, right? People who are chole, He heals them. But then, umatir asurim. There's a progression here from someich nuflim to rofei cholim, and then finally to matir asurim. There are some people who are beyond cholim, they're asurim. And for them, at a certain point, it's matir asurim. Let them go. Matir asurim umechayem munatoli shene afar. Yeah? And then the next step is going to be mechayem etim. Okay? So in that progression, it's almost pshat in the Shmon Esrei, in that bracha, that it means that there comes a time when, you know, we don't pray necessarily for a refuah shleima. Actually, I think it was Persha Valman who commented to me after Rabbi Beller Zichrono Lebracha passed away. We were having a few different places. We did these discussion groups, and she commented to me, you know, for the last few months of his life, the message had been refuah shleima, refuah shleima, tehillim, that Rabbi Beller should get better. And you know, there definitely was a feeling that, what did that mean to get better, right? What was the likelihood that was going to happen in any real fashion, and that it wasn't just going to be prolonged? And she said, you know, maybe what we should have done, and Rabbi Goldberg said something very similar during his talk. He said we should have prayed, you know, that he should be comfortable, that he shouldn't feel pain, that he should be taken care of, that those who are, you know, are taking care of him should have the wisdom to do it in the right way. Right? Sometimes you need to shift the prayer. Refuah Shleima is a little bit too much of a blunt instrument. Right? It's too broad. And sometimes it just feels wrong, you know, saying it to a person. And sometimes the right prayer, I think, what was Rabbi Goldberg's line? God should be gentle. God should be gentle with him or with her. And I think that's a wise idea. That at a certain point, that's what you pray for. Although the Ran here, as we see, takes it, you know, even a step further and says, actually, bepemale, explicitly, pa'amim shetzarich levagesh rachamim ala chole sheyamut. This is very, very striking. I see that it's 10:37. I think we're going to stop here. We got through the raw material. The next time, why don't we get back and we'll look at actual Piskei Halakha. Okay, so we'll look at the progression of how can you choose death in these kinds of situations. I don't want to take too deep into the night.
I just want to say, I think it's very difficult for us to, as human beings, always from people to make a decision of, or make a statement of, you know, maybe we should govern that somebody should die instead of continuing living. It's very anti-Jewish, so to speak.
Well, I mean, I always think it's kind of funny to say something as anti-Jewish when the Ran said it, no? I mean,
no,
I think it may be anti our conception of what Judaism usually calls for, which certainly is life.
Right, exactly. That's what I mean by anti-Jewish. It's like, you know, it seems that, you know, Judaism is for life and not for death.
Absolutely, 100%.
So you know, it's very difficult to, you know, and also it's very difficult for us to, you know, we don't know what Hashem's plan is, you know. So you know, who are we to, call for somebody to die instead of to live?
Absolutely, but Uri, by that token, if we don't know what Hashem's plan is, what's the difference between praying for them to die or praying them to live? Now, obviously, in a vacuum, there's a big difference, right? I'm not saying that we should all pray for people we don't like to die or anything like that. But when you get to these kinds of situations where you see that somebody is suffering, you know, why is it any more humble or pious to pray for the person to live than it is to pray for the person to have an end to their suffering?
I agree with you. If you see somebody suffering, and even if you see somebody, you know, physically suffering and they can't cope anymore, or you have somebody who has real mental health issues,
right?
You know, there is a call, you know, for on both sides. You know, there's a call for, I mean, this, you know, maybe it's better to daven for somebody to, or
at the very least, to make our prayers more ambiguous, so that they allow for it, you know, so that it's not just some refuah shleima, he should get better, but rather that Hashem should be gentle.
Yeah, so refuah shleima, or it just could be refuah shleima, say that the process should be without pain and without too much suffering.
He shouldn't have pain. He shouldn't have pain is a good prayer. He shouldn't have pain. I mean, he should have less pain. I think it's a good prayer. But putting in the refuah shleima, we know what it means. We can't fake what refuah shleima means. It means I hope he gets better. It means I hope he gets back to his feet. I hope he goes back to being normal.
Yeah, but also at the same time, you can say it, but you know it's never going to happen. So it's right. Kind of a pointless.
Then why not say?
And sometimes it's a worthy.
Why not say what?
Why not say something that's kinder?
Right.
If you don't want to be bluntly realistic, something kinder.
Right. So the problem is, though, and I remember saying this at the time, is that you always have to be careful because you never know how the family feels, right? There are some people who are unwilling or unaware or optimistic, and you can't say to them something, and you certainly can't say to the patient, if you don't know how they feel, something that makes them feel like, you know, we've kind of given up, you know? So this is more like beino levein atzmo. This is for a person to know if you're dealing with somebody who's suffering and you're, you know, the principal caretaker, let's say, in that situation, and you're starting to feel, you know, maybe it would be whatever, you should know that, look, there's a ran in the darim. You know, it's not beyond. Then we're going to see there's more to it than just a ran in the darim. But I think it's important to know that and Uri, I think you're acknowledging that it's not necessarily so simple, but it's not necessarily anti-Jewish to think this way. And it requires nuance. And we've seen, you know, multiple Gemaras that address the question from these different perspectives. And we have to realize it's definitely nuanced. I guess it's the equivalent of, you know, my brother was one time walking in Brooklyn, New York, and there's some dispute about the Eruv, okay, in Brooklyn, New York. That's an understatement of the year. And my brother, I think he'd be okay with me mentioning this, that he still, even after everything, he would still use the Eruv. And he was walking with a stroller. And I think one block over, not on our block, but one block over, somebody came out of their house and screamed, this is in Brooklyn, New York, screamed, Shabbos, Shabbos. Which is, I've never seen that in Brooklyn. I have to be honest, I have not experienced that, but he did. But my brother, being the kind of person that he is, just started going, no, it's Tosas Erevin Daf Vav, it's Tosas, look at Tosas over there, he quotes the Bir Halacha. And the guy didn't know what to say. My brother just started quoting sources, shouting sources. So, you know, in this situation, a person tells you, no, it's not right that you should say such a thing, that that a person should not necessarily live, that, and they start yelling at you, b'chaybem, so you say, no, it's around in the darim, go look it up, it's fine, around in the darim. That's it. Okay, next time we'll get down to brass tacks and see what the poskim have to say, from the Shulchan Aruch all the way to contemporary times. So we'll see Rav Moshe, we'll see the Tzitz Eliezer, we'll see Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, we'll see Rav Asher Weiss. Okay?
Sure.
Shkoyach, everybody.
Shkoyach.
Good night.